Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to a Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Deborah Ramsey. I'm a senior lecturer at Exeter University.
And for people outside Britain and some other countries, senior lecturer is like associate professor in many other contexts. It's essentially the same thing. And Prof, tell us what is currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you. What's going on for you?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I've been kind of preoccupied and also dynamized by the prospect of the end of the world. And although I say that lightly, I've kind of also been trying to watch my language around that, because I think this kind of talk of catastrophe is also not necessarily helpful. But my research is in media and conflict, and I've been researching that for a number of years now. But more recently, I've been turning to thinking about war and the environment and the way in which both of those things play out in media. So I'm kind of vacillating between excitement at the moment, because this is kind of like a honeymoon period for me. It's like entering into a new kind of research area. But at the same time, the terror also comes from the stuff I'm researching, and also trying to think about what to do around it. So I know I'm talking work, but this is also very much part of my personal life.
Oh, sure. Of course, these things are often deeply interconnected. Please go ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I find myself sometimes, in fact, last spring, I was sitting outside in my garden in, as we were talking before, in Devon, surrounded by birds on the bird feeder and spring flowers coming up and sunshine, and researching this topic, which also just kind of has recalibrated my view of the world I live in, because it's just, I've been blown away by how much conflict has shaped the world around us in ways that we barely even realize. And by the world around us, I mean particularly what we think of as the natural world, which of course is not separate to us, it's very much part of us, but we've tended to think of it as a separate thing. Yeah, so that's where I am at the moment.
Wow. And in terms of your interest in conflict and war in particular, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what that derives from. I mean, at some level, everyone, depending on their life circumstances, may have a profound commitment to thinking about these things or participating in them or trying to avoid them. But without asking you to be too personal, unless you wish to, what is it intellectually, politically, and or personally that got you moving into this sphere?
I think it's exactly a kind of concentration of those three things: intellectual, personal, and political, because as we know, all of those things overlap. So as you can hear from my accent, I grew up in South Africa, and I grew up in apartheid era South Africa. And by the time I got to university for my first degree, it was a real intensification of the situation in South Africa. And a state of emergency was declared. The government declared a state of emergency. So I come from a military family as well. I should probably throw that into a mix. So I come from a really kind of conservative upbringing in a small town in the Transvaal, near Johannesburg. And I went to a really liberal university for my first degree. And because I was at a really liberal university, it started opening my eyes to what was going on in the country. And because I was doing a media degree, I was doing an acting and media degree, we were also talking about the way in which the conflict in the country was being represented. And then, so that started opening my eyes a little bit. And then I started also seeing things on campus that were later reported on the news. There was a great deal of unrest on campus. And when I saw how that unrest was reported on the news, I started thinking, but that's completely different to what I witnessed. So that, and I mean, everyone, I think one of the things you have to understand about South Africa is that the country's media was really controlled by the government. So you're growing up with only one perspective and you're seeing only one thing. And that moment, those moments really kind of started me on a journey to really thinking about the relationship between governments and media and conflict. And because of that, I developed a real passion in helping my students and people around me understand what media is, what it does, its relationship to other institutions, its relationships to us, and to, for want of a better word, to understanding how to decode what media tells us, to understand why it tells us what it does, how it tells us what it does. I know I'm speaking in very general terms now, but it's not just news media, it's also things like films, television, and digital games, which is what my research has looked at. And I think those relationships come into particular focus when we are talking about moments of conflict or war. So yeah, that's kind of the background to that interest.
And it is fascinating when people from smallish towns or fairly monocultural backgrounds or fairly conservative families get to universities that are liberal.
Exactly right.
This can be a spectacular change, a bit like what Georg Simmel wrote about when he described modernity for women and the movement from small towns to cities, sometimes. Often in impoverishment, sometimes required to do sexual work, but away from the immediate control of the local priest, village gossip, and local patriarchy. The university, for many people, becomes the city for those who don't have the university, or vice versa, I think.
I
And
think that's so true, and I think it's we underestimate, or I think in the way neoliberal universities are now structured, with the absolute emphasis on get your education so that you can go out and get a job and contribute to the economy, I think that completely overlooks the huge value you get just from hearing different ideas, from education in a completely different way, hearing different ideas, seeing people who are have different political perspectives to you, seeing them act on those perspectives. I think all of that is just so important. And it's really made me also passionate about higher education and what it can do. And fighting for the right for it to still be able to do that is really important to me.
That people might not just be consumers and workers, they might also be citizens and family members and friends and lovers and all
Right.
sorts of, and patients and all sorts of categories that universities can help to define and change and also learn from and change from. And Prof. Deborah, an interesting thing for me, when you were talking about the media and the telling of one side of the story, in liberal capitalist democracies, if there ever were or are such things, that was the sort of line I expected from the left for decades and got. Now it's a line I expect and get from the right, who I mean, it's unimaginable how they could think this is true in Britain, where almost every newspaper is on the far, far, far right of world politics, but where the BBC, which is centre right of politics, gains their opprobrium because it dares every now and then to step beyond their crypto fascist beliefs. But nevertheless, this is the mantra that we get all over the far right movements of the world, that the media are the problem, that they don't tell the truth, that they distort everything. In other words, exactly the discourse that came from the left, no?
Right. Absolutely right. And I think also the when I said I was speaking in general terms, I think there is also a danger in what we mean when we talk about the media. And I think when
Yes,
we talk about
yes.
the media, we tend to think about the big institutions. And of course, that's not necessarily the media scape we currently function in is so much more complicated than that.
Yes, yes.
And
Yes,
yes.
I was thinking about journalism, I guess,
Yeah.
in the
Yeah.
way that journalism of the kind that you were experiencing as a young university student in South Africa distort things that we've been part of or seen or heard firsthand, yeah, and the patterns that emerge from that. I guess I was referring to that. And as you indicated earlier, it can be problematic to speak of the media in that way. I was falling into that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's I think one of the only reasons I'm saying that is because my interest particularly lies in looking at the relationship between media technologies and technologies of warfare and how those two have kind of grown up together and how they relate to one another and what they do to each other and how particular technologies of media allow us to understand conflict in particular ways because of their affordances. So I suppose that's one of the reasons why I think we need to move away from talking about the media with the capital T and M and thinking about other ways in which war is mediated, conflict is mediated, and tied in with that, the what is happening in the environment is also the idea of the climate crisis is also mediated in particular ways. And for me, there is nothing more important than talking about those relationships because, as was put up, and this is awful, but I can't remember her name. Great talk spoke about how everything is mediated. And I think that is such an important insight to carry away is that the way we understand the world comes through various forms of media. So, understanding how those forms of media work, nothing is more important than that.
And in terms of these different communications technologies and war, could you give us some examples?
Yeah, sure. So, this is when I said I'm in the honeymoon period, I've just finished one project and I'm moving on to the next.
Whoa,
Yeah,
congratulations.
thank you. So the project I've just finished is a book that looks at operational reporting in the British Army. So it looks at the way in which technologies we don't really think about, but which are technologies of media, things like the pen and the pencil in World War I, the typewriter, and also official forms. So the British Army has since World War I. Every unit in the British Army has been asked to keep a record of their activities, a daily record of their activities, sometimes an hourly record of their activities during conflict and also now during deployment, moments of deployment. And that started in World War I. So it starts out with these very often handwritten entries in the trenches, and it ends today with everything from emails to instant messages that soldiers are exchanging in combat, in the fields of combat today. And what I was interested in looking at is how those official reports, how those technologies shape and inform what goes into those official reports. And those official reports then form the basis of the official histories of warfare and also popular histories of warfare. So it's about tracking. And it's not being deterministic. It's not saying if you use a pencil, you're going to shape the report of war in this way. But it is saying that those technologies do play a role in what gets written down, as well as the actual shape of the official document, the official form. So that's one example. And again, when we think of representations of war, we tend to think of the big ones, the films, the television series, the documentaries, the video games. But in actual fact, there are numerous ways in which war becomes represented. And one of the most important ones is looking at those official channels, because they do then lead to how war is understood and actually waged. How war becomes waged is based on those accounts.
Amazing. And what was it like getting access to these things from a century ago through to today?
There are laws in the UK that govern the release of official documents. So the records of the First and Second World War were the ones that I concentrated on. Today's wars, the more recent wars, it's the rule now is it takes 20 years for official records to cycle into the public domain. So cycling into the public domain at the moment are the records of the Falklands and of the First Gulf War, which is not what I could address in the book at that time. So they are held, and the records of current wars will also be held by the National Archives in the UK. And one of the things I was interested in is also how the archive itself can be understood as a medium that represents these records, and the way in which that representation of the records also shapes your understanding of them. So they're couched very much in language and in structures that are meant to contain them and present them as orderly, understandable records. And in actual fact, when you get into them, they're chaotic. It's a chaotic record. There are just thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. And obviously, I couldn't deal with all of them. I had to select a sample. And even that, just selecting a sample is a process. And one of the things I wanted to do was also bring in my own sense of interacting with the records and my own response to them. Yeah, it was the National Archives is a really interesting institution. It's a mix of trying to be really open and inclusive and welcoming, but of course an archive is not a museum, so that you also come up against these rules and regulations about how you interact with the records. And there are also a lot of barriers in terms of you have to have a kind of understanding of how archival description works. So it's navigating all of that finally gets you into this kind of chaotic record. And it's the intersection between that chaos of the record and these structures that are meant to try and contain it that I found really fascinating.
I've never forgiven it for renaming itself from the Public Records Office, personally.
Yeah, you're right.
These fancy pants historians. So,
Yeah.
in some places where I've been, archivists are musty, like the documents that they used to general. But in some, they're really progressive anarchists, Marxists, feminists. And there's an extraordinary variety of person functioning in these places, but I've found them to be very dedicated both to the preservation of their materials and to the availability of those materials where possible. But I've had somewhat limited experience, but it's always been positive in that sense. The chaos is really interesting that you mention. Because, of course, once this turns into a conventional war history, it's ordered often by chronology
Exactly right.
and given a certain rationality. And question about some of these things in a more mythological sense. The Second World War is the only justification for that the United States and Britain can ever really give for their imperialistic warmongering around the globe. It is used both retrospectively and prospectively
Yeah.
as a rationale. And the whole idea of a just war, Michael Waltz's arguments really derive from the notion we did one good thing, damn it, damn it. We got rid of those Nazis and those other fascists. And this becomes a glorification not only of those moments, but of a raison d'etre for everything that goes after, and even things leading up to that moment. And so I'm interested, I guess, because of perhaps my age, but also that orientation, that philosophical and historical orientation, as to how important the Second World War was in what you found.
I so in terms of the records, I think I can't really so in terms of that book, I don't think it really kind of addresses that question you're asking. There are some trends that you can identify in the records themselves that are tied to broader trends in British society, because this book was particularly about the British Army, so that are tied to British society as a whole. Trends of, for example, suppressing certain emotions and not allowing those to come through in the record. So I mentioned chaos deliberately because neither in the first nor in the Second World War records that I looked at, bearing in mind that this is a massive corpus and I couldn't look at them all, but certainly in the ones I saw, there is never any outright mention of chaos, even in absolutely chaotic situations. It's always really downplayed to things like there was disruption or those kinds of words are used rather than in certain circumstances, we know that what was happening on the battlefield was absolutely chaotic. So there's that. There's also fear is never mentioned. And this is even in the First World, with the records of the First World War. And the most you'll get are things like the men were shaken or severely shaken. And you do get the occasional mention of shell shock. So I think what I'm getting at is that even in the official records, which are meant to be, which are generally understood as emotionless, they're not emotionless, but what they do is they highlight certain emotions. So instead of fear, you get things like cheeriness, especially in the First World War. Cheeriness is emphasized, the cheeriness of the men. In the Second World War, you get this kind of, and it also comes out of the First World War, this kind of nonchalance is really valued. And that idea of being really cool under pressure is also valued by the British Army itself in terms of how it expects men to perform. So I guess what I'm saying in response to that question from this book is that what you get from these wars is a kind of understanding of the way in which the British Army handled itself. Which then lays the foundations for how it goes into future wars, one of which is a complete disregard for the emotional impact of war. It's why the army is so bad at handling trauma. But in earlier work, I looked at the role of the Second World War in in the States, and that you can really see the you can see how the idea of this war is a good war evolves in the years after the war. But it starts when the war is taking place, in part because the real horrors of the war don't really register in American media in any real way. The real damage that war can do on people and on animals and on space. It registers a little bit, but not in a massive way because Americans are not seeing that firsthand as Europeans are. So I think that's what makes it possible for for the idea that it is possible to wage war honorably and to wage a good war. I think that's where that comes from.
And this is you're referring here to your book, American Media and the Memory of World War II, a terrific book, very valuable, I guess. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted there. Go ahead.
No, that's I just found it fascinating how that whole movement towards the good war could be traced and how certain things get left out, some things persist. I'm also interested very often in memory studies, the emphasis is on what remains the same. or what's not what remains the same, what changes according to the needs of the present. And I was much more interested in what persists. So the idea of the American citizen soldier, for example, as a fine, upstanding member of society and member of the military, that it definitely persists. It starts to get a little bit disrupted in places, but that disruption doesn't really, again, is not powerful enough to challenge the whole construct. And then, of course, that translates directly into the current wars, where we can go there and do what we did in World War II and save the world and make the world a better place for democracy.
And you dedicate the new book to somebody, to your dad. So there's something here about trying to understand the sort of world that he occupied professionally, although he was in South Africa, as well as how that world might have been shaped by men like him.
Yes, exactly right. So my father was a pilot in the South African Air Force. He was killed in a mid-air collision when I was very young. I was 2 and a half. So I don't have many. I don't have memories of him, but obviously I have memories of the impact that that loss did to our family. My grandfather was also in the Air Force, so I grew up very much on or near Air Force bases, and the Air Force. I suppose at that stage, the South African Air Force kind of saw itself as an elite and potentially even possibly slightly more liberal than, say, a slightly more liberal organization than, say, the South African Army, but it wasn't really. And my father was Afrikaans. My mother was from an English-speaking family, and that in itself caused, my mother told me that my father's family initially were quite reluctant to accept her. So those kind of dynamics, as you beautifully put it, kind of understanding the world that is made by military men, the world he functioned in, as well as the world that I grew up in and the world that we live in today, kind of connecting all of those things is very much, it's so difficult, isn't it, sometimes to separate the personal from work in, well, for me it is anyway.
Oh, sure. And the other thing, of course, is that this is a book which you wrote, and you're writing about writing,
Yes.
which you explain very elegantly in the introductory remarks to the book about trying to think about the processes, both the communications technologies, as you say, but also the mental processes that go into satisfying the requirements of a form, designing a form, satisfying its requirements when filling it out, reading it, that whole material cultural history of these reports is foregrounded in a way that an empiricist historian drawing on them as some level of truth rarely probably thinks about.
Yeah, I think there are historians who recognize that these records must always be used in conjunction with other material. But having said that, I think the thing that really fascinated me was how history has become about writing. History came about when records came about, really, and that became history's material. Scientific material. I think the whole book was really about bureaucracy, funnily enough, and the bureaucratization of war, and also of what we do, how what we do is based on bureaucratic structures and also conventions that we accept. Like you write a book, you reference a whole bunch of other people who've also written books in order to demonstrate your kind of mastery in writing books, which is kind of, and I know obviously I'm simplifying it because it's also about being in dialogue with other scholars and calling on that interaction, and that's what we're doing when we're citing other people. But all of it is just based on mediated written stuff. And it was the nature of that mediated written stuff that was interesting to me in that book, for sure.
For sure. And just before we move on to your first book in greater detail, if we could, I'd really like you to share with us something of what surprised you or didn't, or both, as you made your way through the archive.
I think the thing that surprised me and that I made me want to write about it was how the individual shone through these official forms. So just for people who don't know, very often the people who are completing these forms, you don't know who they are. They don't often put their names in it. It's meant, the form is meant to be quite literally a form of communication between the people in the field and the remainder of the army as an organization. And what really struck me was how individuals push back at that and the way they push back at that. So the one thing I didn't write about in the book is this extraordinary typed excerpt from a record in World War I, where the person who was writing it clearly had a really lovely, dark sense of humor. And he details in one of his accounts the nocturnal activities of a group of officers who are stuck in a building while there's shelling happening all around them. And what he's talking about is how they irritate each other by snoring, how one of them thinks he's lost something, so he wakes all the others up and makes them look for it, to the extent that they're even accusing each other of taking it. And eventually he realizes that it's around his neck. It's always been around his neck, and they all go back to sleep. And that's a completely, that and a record I did include in the book in World War II, which was from the Welsh Guards at the Battle of Nymagen, which is quite an important point in Operation Market Garden in World War II. And a couple of them just go off on this rather wonderful trek across Europe to get some wine and some alcohol for the unit. And they go through the brothels of Paris. They have a lovely time. It's almost like a summer holiday. And it includes some ruminations on war. He talks about war as a kind of soldiers being as the kind of grapes that are being pressed through this experience of war and coming out as wine at the end. But it's very funny. He does illustrations, and this made it into the official record.
Wow.
And historians will often, that's not what they're interested in because that
Yeah.
is the personal stuff. But I got really interested in the way the individual, I see that almost as a kind of resistance to the official structure, because it is, it's mimicking the form of the official report, but it is doing something completely unofficial in it. And I just think those moments were really interesting and kind of mind-blowing.
I'll say, wow. And fascinating that they made it into this kind of record, actually.
Yeah, they were just swept up in the files. Hand to hand to hand, went through offices and eventually ended up in the National Archives, which is, just in some ways astonishing.
Really interesting. So, moving on then to the first book, if we could, from 2015. And you write about this in terms of, in part, the way the 1990s became a celebration of half a century of freeing the world, in commas. And you write about it not only in terms of things like Saving Private Ryan, one of the films that you discuss, but also what was an occasion for the efflorescence of electronic games, particularly first-person shooter games. So I wonder if you could perhaps take us through the book a bit in terms of both the content that you observed, or in terms of three things, the content you observed, the different technologies, and also an overarching concept that you're deploying, which is that of memory.
I got interested in the way in which World War II kind of keeps cycling back in and out of American media. They're kind of waves of it that happen. And the most recent wave for me kind of started in the 1990s with Saving Private Ryan. So I'm trying to remember all the things you asked me about.
Sorry. I made it a multi-part question, which is not the
I
way
should
to
have
go.
made notes.
Forget about that. My apologies. It was my
No,
fault.
don't apologize. It was interesting and I wanted to hold on to it, but I thought, right, if I talk about the overarching interests, that might give me a way into what you were asking.
Let's go back to that then, the question of memory.
Okay, the question of memory. The thing that interested me again about memory and conflict is that, well, certainly for most of us now, the only way we understand World War II is through media. So our memories of it is based on those mediated representations. But also veterans from World War II and also later from Vietnam very often talk about how they struggle sometimes with understanding whether what they're remembering is what happened or what they've seen in various representations of war. So I got interested in how that was all tangled up. And that was what I wanted to look at in that book, kind of understanding how the relationship between media and memory, the broader relationship, but then how we understand war and remember war through these big media forms. And the thing that I think made sense for me was that a lot of what I was seeing in memory studies wasn't entirely explaining the way in which these big conflicts kind of cycle back and how they gain a kind of momentum of their own. And talking about things like cultural memory, this memory studies is such a complex field, as you probably know, but talking about all these kind of different ways of understanding memory, in a way, felt like they still weren't quite explaining what I needed to kind of understand. So I shifted away from that and instead thought, right, I'm going to concentrate on what I'm actually seeing in mediated representations, rather than trying to understand how that connects to the way we remember. Because to me, that needs empirical evidence. I need to provide empirical evidence of how people are remembering. So instead, what I looked at was how World War II, for want of a better word, gets constructed in American media. And the big media at the time I was writing was obviously film and television, but video games had, as you say, started to come in the 1990s. And then also World War II started to be a really important conflict for video games. So it was looking at that moment and looking at across what I called a rather clunky term, but the transmedia mnemonic structure of World War II, kind of looking at how that spread out into different forms of media and how we could understand it. Because the other important thing to me was very often when people talk about media and memory, they'll talk about one medium. They'll talk about film, or they'll talk about news media, or they'll talk about slightly more rarely television. And we know that's not how we understand the world. We live in a world where we get our understanding from a huge range of media. So what I was interested in looking at was how that structure of World War II extended across various media forms, what was similar across those forms, and perhaps what they did differently. So video games, for example, the thing they do differently, quite obviously, is that element of play. So you can never analyze a video game purely in terms of what it looks like perhaps you can think about doing with a film, although again, that's an oversimplification. But that element of play is something we really need to think about. And then I started becoming interested in what the first person shooter was doing that other forms of media weren't. And instead of thinking about, because there's a whole lot that's been written about what first person shooters don't do and what they should do, I wanted to look at what I thought they were actually doing. And the important intervention they make for me is a reminder that war is not just about trauma and noble sacrifice. And that, of course, that trauma narrative also only starts to come out in the 80s and 90s. It's not just about trauma and noble sacrifice. That's not what soldiers go onto the battlefield to do. They go onto the battlefield to try and survive. And in trying to survive, they are also trying to kill as many of the people who are trying to kill them as possible. It's about killing. And that's what games do, is that they remind us that war is about killing. And that sometimes, despite the trauma narrative and all the rest of it, there are soldiers who test, and there are veterans who testify to this throughout history. War is a complex phenomenon, and part of that phenomenon is that war can sometimes be vastly exhilarating and, for want of a better word, fun. And again, games remind us of that. As uncomfortable as that is to think about.
Yes, of course, of course. And those of us who might not like vigilantism, but derive some kind of pleasure from seeing a character derided as bad in the diegesis of a film getting beaten to a pulp by a character encoded as
Exactly
good.
right. Yeah, exactly right.
And human rights go out the window, laws go out the window.
Yeah.
Compassion as well.
And I think that's, to come back to what you were saying earlier, I think that's why World War II lends itself so easily to being adapted into game form. It's one of the reasons. And it is because you have a clear good guy, bad guy narrative. It's easy to beat Nazis to a pulp. It's easy to in game form. I'm not saying that, in real life, but in game form, you have a clear, what appears to be a clear moral standpoint in the
Yeah,
war. Of
right.
course, in reality, we know that World War II was not that clearly morally defined, and the Allies also did reprehensible things, but you've got that kind of clear good and evil. You've got clear good guys, bad guys.
Yeah, it makes for a sort of satisfying binarism
Yeah.
where you can identify whom you wish to support very easily. And of course, there are complex representations of this conflict, but they tend to humanize people on the side of the resistance or the victory of the United Nations, as it then was. Well, Prof, I have one more question for you, if I may, and then I'd like to invite you to finish off by adding anything that we've not discussed. Does that sound okay?
That sounds lovely.
So the last question's this. To the extent you feel able to do so without giving away state secrets or things that only the PRO, sorry, National Archives at Kew, will ever be allowed to find out, what's the next project?
Next project is looking at the intersections between media conflict and climate change. And so that's the overarching project. And as part of that, the things I've been writing about recently and the things I'm working towards is thinking about how, because that's also missing. Like I said, the chaos of war is missing. The impact that war has on the environment and on the non-human world is very much missing from our representations of war. We just don't see it. You don't see the huge amount of animal deaths, the huge amounts of destruction that happens to the world. We don't see the long-term impacts of conflict either, because those aren't terribly easy to represent. So I want to think about the challenge of how we make those harms, the eco harms of conflict, past, present, and future, visible in ways that are engaging and impactful enough to start to draw the attention of policymakers potentially, but to remind us that War is not something that happens just between humans. It's something that destroys the world around us, and eventually, because it does that, it also has an impact on us.
Yes, terrible impact on soil, on
Exactly
plant
right.
life, on our fellow animals. So many things, and deriving from so many sources. At the same time, the technologies that you and I are using to speak to one another now derive in part from often contracts given by the Pentagon to US universities that then get handed over to capitalism for commercial refinement. And I'm thinking of, everything from the sort of Paul Virilio writing about technologies in war, and Brian Winston, and loads of feminist scholars like Judy Weitzman, but lots of others writing about the occupied nature of these communications technologies. But in addition to that nexus with war often being left out, there is also this notion of media technologies being lenses on the climate, where in fact they're purposive actors in the climate. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, it's just so entangled, and that's one of the things I want to try and explore. And I think that's why so urgently we need responses that are not just from a single discipline. We need responses from that are multidisciplinary and that are extend across national borders, because these entanglements are often so invisible as well. I mean, just it's one of the things I talk to my students about, is just understanding that so much of what we have and do today, whether it's even, computer games, are completely entangled. The technology comes out of funding from military sources. So untangling those things is, I mean, for want of a better word, it's a wicked problem, in that it needs a number of, it probably doesn't have a solution, but it needs to be thought of in a number of different ways. So that's what I'm trying to do, is involve as many sectors, as many disciplines as I can in addressing the problem of how we make some of this stuff visible.
Wonderful. What an exciting project. So, Prof. Deborah, I'd like to hand over to you now, lest there be things you wish to add to what we've discussed.
Toby, this has just been such a lovely, it's always so lovely just to have a chance to talk about our work, because very often you're doing it in isolation, right? And you don't know how it's landing or where it's going. You send these books out into the world and you've no idea what happens to them. So all I can say is it's been great to connect. I don't think I left anything out. And thank you so much for the opportunity to just have a chat.
Thank you so much. It was great. Bye for now.